Now, this is the second message of three regarding the resurrection as we continue on in our book of Mark. And what I want to talk about today is the accepted means for validating any historic event. Any historic event. It doesn't matter what it is. It's taught in first-year law school. It's called evidence. And in forensics labs for science. Exactly how one determines the validity of a historic event. Evidence enters our minds, one, we process it in some way, and it leads us to a conclusion. I want to talk a little bit about logic and reason and what it is, how it works, and these are things we already know, maybe not in this form or have heard it in this way, but you know these things. They're innate. They're within you. Each human is given the ability to communicate at birth. Every human. And it takes a while for the child that comes into the world to understand different concepts, to be able to process them. But they already know how to process. That's given by God. Now, God imparts logic and reason to everyone at birth. Young children have this ability. They can figure this out very, very quickly. Their minds are just as sharp as tacks. They know that. They may not have the experience and the information, but the process is there. It comes from God. Matter of fact, in the first chapter of Isaiah, the 18th verse, God says to the Jews, come, let us reason together. And he's talking about their sins being scarlet, and he says, and I will make them as white as snow. But the idea is that he's telling them, let's reason together. In other words, communicate with me. Think through this with me. He's trying to show them that what they're doing is outside of his will. And the way he does this is by reasoning with them. You know, if you've listened to kids play or you've done it yourself, you hear one kid will say something, the other one, yeah, who says? Or they'll say, well, how do you know that? And then finally, a lot of them will say, so what? So what? These are very, very sound arguments within logic and reason. Very sound arguments. Because we validate information this way. So, who says is actually a validation or a request to validate an authoritative source. Let me see your source for this. It's much easier to say, yeah, who says? That's what we do. We do this. Now, how do you know is actually a method to get us to understand the channel of this information. How did that information get into you? How do you know that? How do you know that? Not just who you heard it from, but how did it get to you? And so what is simply, how does this piece of information affect me? I mean, why should I care about that? And you see little kids do this all the time. Who says? Yeah, how do you know that? So what? Computer technology, as an example, was designed based on our thought process. Matter of fact, it's interesting. The Hebrew word for to think is choshev. Choshev. And for a computer, it's machshev. They've taken the verb to think and they've just added a prefix and a suffix. So a computer comes about from the model of our thought process and the original designers of a central processing unit, which is the little piece of hardware inside the computer that actually does the thinking. And the hard drive is where data is stored. Like our memory or our experiences. And the keyboard and the mouse are like input devices, getting information in to the computer. The eyes and ears of a human being are the gates that get information into our brain, which is the central processing unit, okay? Just like the keyboard and the mouse. Same thing. And the output device of the computer, sometimes speakers or the monitor, it's like our voice. Our voice is taking information that has come in through the ear gate, through the eye gate. We've processed it. We have information already in there, like the hard drive on the computer. That's there. That is there. The information that we have collected, some call this our preconceived notions, our worldview, or a resident body of information. Whatever you want to call it, it's information that we have collected over our lives. Some of it is good, most of it is bad. And when I say bad, I mean inaccurate. You hear people frequently say, well, I heard, wait a minute. That is hardly a validation of authenticity. I heard. It doesn't work. When information comes into us, we do one of three things. We either accept it, we reject it, or we just decide not to do anything with it, and we'll look at it a little later on. Nah, too much here. I don't want to talk about it right now. If the information doesn't make sense to us, we reject it. We just say, that doesn't make any sense at all, and you just let it go. But we are unlike a computer. See, we can make sense of things. Computer can only do what it's programmed to do. There's an old saying, you put garbage in, you get garbage out. So you got to be careful what you put in your computer. Just because the computer tells you something doesn't mean it's correct. It's only going to spit back to you what you put into it. There are known laws of logic that have been discovered. They haven't been made up because we did not make logic and reason. God did, but we've discovered these things. We didn't create them. There's two basic fundamental laws of logic that I want to talk to you about for just a few minutes. And the first one is a syllogism. A syllogism. A syllogism is a Greek word for a conclusion. And it's kind of a logical argument from premises that reach a conclusion or a proposition, I should say. So, for example, if I said, all automobiles are red. I just bought an automobile. Therefore, the color of my automobile is red. And it follows. It follows. Now, that's the other element. A non sequitur. Sequitur just means it follows. Okay, the first one is from Greek. Excuse me. It's from Greek. Means conclusion. A sequitur or a non sequitur in the case of what we're going to talk about here is from the Latin. It does not follow. It does not follow. And in formal arguments, a non sequitur is a conclusion that does not follow the premise. Okay, all cars are red. I just bought a house. Therefore, my house is red. And you would look at that and say, besides you being crazy, it doesn't follow. You just know this. But that's the way our brains work. Automatically. You look at somebody and you say, that just doesn't, you're nuts. It doesn't follow at all. But why do we care about this stuff? Because this logic and reason is the way you validate historic events. And I've just broken them down, an historic event and a process, into its smallest components that you already know. Maybe not by these terms or in this way, but you already know this stuff. It's inside you. It's innate. This is how we persuade people, though, to understand the Bible. This is how we persuade people to understand the Bible. Some people you're never going to persuade. They're never going to accept it, and they don't care. Now, we usually don't think in these terms, But if we're saying something that doesn't make sense, it doesn't follow, then the person is not going to understand what we're saying, and they're just going to move away from us. They're just going to not, they're not going to have an interest in what we're saying. Some people think Christianity and Christians are just a bunch of myth followed by robots that just take what they're given and say, I believe this, without understanding it. Christianity is a faith based upon the way the world is, that's defensible, it's logical, and it's reasonable, and it's the only set of religious ideas that's based on fact, not on somebody pushing a belief into you with a clever set of ideas like the cults. Some appeal to others about Christianity from an emotional basis. Oh, let me tell you what happened to me. Let me tell you what happened to me. I was saved, and those are good stories. Those are good stories. But if you don't have any facts to support the authenticity of the Bible, the facts of Christ's resurrection, emotionalism only lasts for a while. People want something more substantive after that. And if they don't get facts after the emotional entrance, they lose interest and they move away. Now, there's two kinds of ways to prove any historical event. The first one is if you can recreate the event, you do so. A scientific experiment, for example. You control the environment, holding things constant, and you recreate the event and you watch for an outcome. You can do this. A mathematical equation is one thing. It falls in that category. Chemistry experiments, there's all kinds of other things. The scientific process is one of conducting a set of circumstances that are heavily monitored and looking for the outcome when you can control these things. Obviously, we can't control what I had for lunch yesterday. Or, did Jesus rise from the dead 1987 or 88 years ago? You can't control a historical event and recreate it. This is one of the big problems with the evolutionist. They have no evidence for their supposition. No evidence. But they continue to say, science tells us. Science is a process of conducting an experiment and observing its outcome. You can't recreate creation. You have to rely on eyewitness accounts. But that's outside of what our discussion is here. Many individuals have looked at this Bible critically and have tried to validate the events from the standpoint of debunking it. And they have turned around and become believers because you can't debunk factual historical events. Now, how do you authenticate a historical event if you can't recreate it? Well, one way is through eyewitness accounts. Another way is to amass evidence that coincides with the eyewitness accounts. And I just want to leave those two for the time being because this subject is pretty vast and there's thousands of volumes written on this subject on the authenticity of these events. I was in a discussion with an individual quite a while ago, and I asked them, in arguing for the crucifixion, how do you validate a historic event? Well, I look at the photographs. Oh, okay. Was there ever a First World War? Well, of course there was. How do you know? Well, I saw the pictures. Okay. Was there a Civil War? Of course there was. How do you know? I saw the pictures. In other words, a means of an eyewitness account. I said, okay, photography was only invented by a French guy around 1810 or so. What about the American Revolutionary War? Was there American Revolutionary War? Well, yeah. No, you don't have any photographs. Boy, everything changes, and you can see the gears changing, you know, shifting. How do you validate a historic event? It's not with photographs, although since photography, that's an added help, and movies and so on of, you know, actual events. But we have evidence, and we rely on the evidence, and there's tests for evidence. You know, Christianity is very coherent and corresponds to the world around us. Any other set of religious ideas, including the cults, don't match up with reality. Now, some people say about the resurrection, well, resurrections, okay, using your logic and reason, resurrections don't happen, therefore, Jesus did not rise from the dead. Well, that's a non sequitur. It doesn't follow because your first premise is faulty. You're making a conclusion as your premise saying, well, resurrections don't happen. My question is, how do you know that? Well, they just don't. How do you know that? Where's your evidence that resurrections don't happen? Well, they don't have any. That's a false assumption. Paul brings that out in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. He says, some of you are saying, now bear in mind now, this is 2,000 years ago, this is the first century. Some of you are saying that resurrections don't happen. He says, if that's true, we're still dead in our sins. May as well live life to its fullest because there's nothing here but death and despair and disease and wars and famine and you name it, you know, you name it. But it did happen. Because we have eyewitness accounts and we got evidence. We have been given more than just logic and reason. We have been given a will, an independent ability to exert our will. We don't have, as some call it, a free will. That's a misnomer. Our will is not free. In other words, our will does not mean that we can choose things and then go ahead and do them. You can't. You can't choose to fly off the top of this building. You know, you can't defy gravity. You can't defy physics. You can't do a lot of things. I could say, well, you know, I can move to Scotland right now if I wanted to. No, I can't. My economic situation here and my wife here and my family and all kinds of other ties here will never let me move there. And if I try to do that, I am going to disrupt so many things and mess so many things up that it's not worth it. You can't do things. You don't have a free will, but you have a will. Okay? You have a will. Now, what does that mean? Give you an example that I put in your notes there. If you put a lariat or some sort of a rope around a burro's neck and you want to pull it in one direction, it can either go with you or it can dig in its hooves and say, nope, turn its neck and be stubborn and say, I'm not moving. Those are the two ways to exert your will, in compliance or in rejection. Now, as you move through your time on earth, you're going to get a lot of information coming in to you. Some is accurate, but as I mentioned before, most of it is not accurate. It's just information. Here, you're going to get correct, verifiable information about this Bible every week. You can look this stuff up. You can test the words. You can test what I say with Scripture. It's not going to be inaccurate unless I make a mistake, which I do, and people correct me, and that's great. You're supposed to do that. You know, we've got this story of this group of people here in Acts 17:11 called the Bereans. They would listen with expectancy about what the Apostle Paul said. Then they go home and they look up in their Bibles and make sure he was telling them the truth. That's what you ought to be doing, too. You ought to be checking out with what I say with the scripture. Is what I'm saying here accurate? Because if you are getting information that doesn't square with the Bible, you're going to have to ask yourself, do I believe this or do I not believe this, and why? And about Christianity and about the resurrection, the most important events in the face of this earth, if you are going to reject Christ, know why you're doing it. Don't just say, oh, I'm not going to believe that. Why? And I've heard people say, well, I just can't. Well, what is there about these factual events that cause you to reject them? There's some blinder, some blockage, something in front of them that is causing them to reject it. I've had people that I've witnessed to block their ears and start to make noise. They don't want it coming in. They don't want to listen. They can't do that. More than one. It's important for our logic and reason to have a satisfied repose about a decision. You get information coming in, especially about this topic. You got to satisfy yourself that it's true or not true, accurate, inaccurate. Because if you don't do that, you're going to reject it. That's the default. Reject, not pay attention. No, I'm not going to accept this. But you don't know why, because you haven't gone the extra step to defend your decision. The results of this particular choice have eternal outcomes. Because what Christ speaks about and the reason he came and the whole idea of this death and resurrection is so that you can have eternal life when you leave this body. And everybody leaves these bodies. Nobody stays. Look around you. Nobody is staying here. Nobody. Believing or not believing is your choice. You can exert your will on these fundamental principles here of truth and fact that are verifiable. You can do it or you can say yes or no. It's your choice. And for some, there is no amount of information, factual information, that will ever get them to a belief. Now, mathematicians call this an asymptotic graph. I put the wrong axis down. There's supposed to be an x-axis. Correct that, please, in your notes there, not the y-axis. The x-axis is the bottom, okay? And the y-axis is the top. If the x-axis is time and the y-axis is our amount of information about the resurrection, and someone starts studying, well, that graph goes up, and it's up, and it's up, and it gets up near the top, which could be perfect knowledge, the x-axis at the top, perfect knowledge. You'll know everything. Well, you're never going to get there because you're a human and you don't know everything. But the curve kind of levels out up there, and it travels along that x-axis at the top. That's called asymptotic in mathematics. And it travels along. There are some people that will never make a decision. They get so much information, and well, they got everything that's available, and that's not enough. And there's a variety of reasons for that. There are bad seminaries, and they're growing every day. There are terrible churches. There are denominational teachings that are outside the authority of the Bible. There are even lots of big churches today that are debunking the Bible. Well, we don't use that. It's old. It's good luck. Good luck. Good luck. People have received poor or corrupt information and have decided, well, none of this has any value because your logic and reason are seeing this is not making any sense. So you go, well, this is just, you know, why should I believe this and not Shintoism or some other, you know, New Age or something? That's because you got bad information. You didn't get accurate historical facts, of which there are no accurate historical facts like this in other religious ideas. I have to tell you that this is a product of what is taking place in the heavenlies right now. Satan has been trying to jam the communications of God since the Garden of Eden. In any military warfare, the troops have got to be in communication with the commanding officer. They have got to act out the strategy, and they've got to provide feedback back to the commander if the strategy is failing. Some new circumstances have come up. You've got to get back to the command center so that they can reevaluate it from a much bigger picture level and give you new information. Send reinforcements in, move you to the flank or something, or pull you back. Without that communication, they're lost. And in warfare, that's one of the strategies. You jam your opponent's communication so he can't connect with his commanding officer. That's what Satan's been trying to do since the Garden of Eden. He's been trying to jam the communication, and he does it very, very good. And one of the ways he does this is by keeping the Bible away from people. Telling people it's not true. It's not factual. You don't want to believe this stuff. And he's good at it. He's infected seminaries. He's infected churches. And he's infected people's lives with his lies. He is the father of lies. And he is very, very good about this. Now, the Bible has been proven over and over and over again to be factual. One of the chief proponents of this that has written a lot about it and is used as a basis for most apologetics study today, and apologetics just mean a defense of the faith, a guy named Simon Greenleaf. He was in 1846, he was a well-decorated, they called him the Dean Professor of Harvard Law School. He was a known expert in the field of evidence. Known expert. He wrote a treatise on evidence that was, it's still a classic. But his stuff was used, but he made a contribution to biblical Christianity that is unparalleled. And it's a book called The Testimony of the Evangelists, Examined by the Rules of Evidence Administered in Courts of Justice. That is a book that all apologetic students in seminaries must read. You got to understand this, because what Greenleaf did was he took Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and he said, let's conduct a mock trial, if you will, or a shadow trial, they called it. And let's see if what they're saying holds up as we would any other body of evidence, any other testimony, any other eyewitness accounts. And what he starts off this book is saying is, let the evidence tell the story. Don't read something into it. Let these guys say what they're saying, and let's look at this. He says, Christianity, from a purely legal sense now, there's all kinds of other ways of validating Christianity, but just from the legal arena, he said it does not bring irresistible evidence, but it offers sufficient evidence to get somebody to see that it's true. Okay? And he says, we're going to do this, or he's going to do this, like we would in any other tribunals or any other courts of law. We're going to test these guys as witnesses, and we're going to test the veracity of their witness by the same rules that we use in other courts. First, he starts off with the known use of a legal concept called the ancient documents rule. And that one says, every document, apparently ancient, coming from the proper repository or custody, and bearing on its face no evident marks of forgery, the law presumes to be genuine, and it devolves on the opposing party the burden of proving it to be otherwise. This is so fundamental. People will say, well, I don't believe that. Christianity is not true. I don't believe Jesus rose from the dead. I don't believe this. And you go, oh, what evidence do you have? Well, I don't know. It's just about it. And they'll just wilt because they don't have any evidence. And what he's saying here, in essence, if they make an assertion that something is not true, we're talking about the Bible here and the testimony of these four evangelists. If they make a statement that it's not true, tell them to prove it. Hey, that's what we're about here. We're about proving things. How do you prove that? Well, they can't. So they'll get blustery and emotional and all kinds of junk, and they'll take you off the topic. Don't let them do that. This is what they do. But it's important to understand that we prove things by evidence and eyewitnesses. And Christianity is not fanciful. Christianity is based on truth, known historic events, and we use this in our logic and reason. So anyway, Greenleaf said he didn't see any forgeries in these. The oldest ones available were received into the court, as he's using it here, as genuine documents. There's no compelling evidence to the contrary. Nobody says, well, that didn't happen. That's not true. That's not a good eyewitness account. Nobody. Not for the first 300 years of Christianity. Nobody said there wasn't a resurrection, for example, because that's what our specific topic is today here, okay? But detractors will, what I call, engineer specious arguments, meaning they'll come up with clever arguments that have no basis, and they won't prove them, but they keep barking it out, keep barking it out, keep barking it out. You know, Joseph Goebbels was one of the ministers under Adolf Hitler. He was the propaganda guy, and he used to say that if you can get a lie out loud enough, frequently enough, people will believe it, because that's what they keep hearing. That's what they keep hearing, and Satan is good at this. It's good at this, but there's arguments. When you're faced with this, ask somebody, where's your evidence that this didn't happen? Where's your evidence? What you find is you get people that don't want to think. I call this a sloppy thought process. They just accept something without really looking at it and examining it. The second step in Greenleaf's argument is, he said, people that are knowledgeable about a particular subject are presumed to be conversant in what their experience has been. What, you know, you should be able to tell me about your own affairs, your own issues, your own experience. So he's saying Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were either apostles or right next to apostles and were there. Unless you can show me that they lied somehow, we have to presume that these guys are telling the truth. Then he builds this case, and he's got this shadow. It's kind of cool. He builds a shadow cross-examination. Now, I'm not going to go into the whole book. I mean, it's this thick about how he does this, but it's really, really good. And Greenleaf develops his case on this test. I'm going to read from him again. The credit due to the testimony of witnesses depends, firstly, upon their honesty, secondly, their ability, thirdly, their number, and the consistency of their testimony, and fourthly, the conformity of their testimony with experience, and fifthly, the coincidence of their testimony with collateral circumstances. In other words, we read something about what's happening here, and do these guys' experiences and discussion of events match up with what's going on from others? Then he argues that they were honest. They don't show any motives to be false. And he maintains that any discrepancies in their accounts are able to be reconciled because that's natural. You expect that. If you get three people watching a car accident at an intersection, one is going to say, boy, I saw it. The blue car just rammed right into the green car. And the green car turned this way, and the blue car then, when the guy got out of the blue car, and a second guy's going to say, oh, yeah, you should have seen how fast that car was going. And then it leaped up in the air. And then they're going to talk about different aspects of the same incident based upon what they focused in on. But there's going to be corroboration between most of it. They're going to see different aspects. That's what we get from the book of 1 and 2 Kings, or 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and then you go over to 1 and 2 Chronicles. Same stuff, slightly different information. It's adding or subtracting from it. Same stuff. Anyway, Greenleaf looks at the problem of the uniform testimony about false and genuine witnesses, and he comes to the conclusion that based upon what these guys said and using rules of evidence and eyewitness accounts, he said, these guys are telling the truth. They're telling what they actually saw. Now, I'm not going to go into the text that I put down there right after that because you can look at that later. But it's basically just saying, follow the evidence. Follow the evidence. Legal reasoning is one way to determine religious truth, and it's of tremendous value in Christianity because Christianity is the only religion in the world that has true claims of historic events that can be tested by legal reasoning and facts. There isn't any other religion. And the person that says, well, how do you differentiate Christianity from, you know, Buddhism or something? Well, that person is obviously not knowledgeable at all about Christianity or the facts of Christianity. What happened? That's where you start. I mean, if you have the opportunity. Now, I'm going to close today with a bunch of pieces of evidence about the resurrection. These are facts. Jesus of Nazareth is a Jewish prophet, a claim to be the Messiah, prophesied in the Jewish scriptures, was judged a political criminal, crucified 3 days later after his death and burial. Some women went to the tomb, found the body gone. Subsequent weeks, his disciples claimed that God had raised him from the dead, and that he appeared to them at various times before ascending back to heaven. From that foundation, Christianity spread throughout the Roman Empire and has continued to exert a great influence down through the centuries. That's the broad picture. That's what happened. If somebody says that didn't happen, say, what did and how do you know? What evidence do you have? They can't answer you. You hear things like, well, it just stands to reason, or it just can't be, or everything but a fair evaluation bringing evidence. The New Testament accounts of the resurrection were being circulated at the time that this happened. They were all over the place. Everybody knew this, and had this been a lie, The Jews and the Romans would have stopped it right away. They would have published things all over the place saying, oh, that's a bunch of lies. Nothing got published. Nothing. Nobody was speaking out that that's not true. The ruling religious Jews tried to stop it from being promulgated, but they couldn't dispute that Jesus had risen from the dead. They couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. And as I'd mentioned before, and I'm going to mention this again, for the first 300 years, nobody denied the resurrection of Jesus. If I denied that George Walker Bush was the last president of the United States before the present one, I said, there is no George. There was no George Walker Bush. He didn't exist. You'd all look at me like I was crazy. And you'd show me newspaper articles and magazines and pictures and all kinds of things as evidence. And I wouldn't have a leg to stand on. So I'm not even going to say something that stupid. Over time, Satan convinces people that historic events are not true. And I've mentioned this before. We're seeing already denials, worldwide denials, of the Holocaust in Nazi Germany, where millions of people lost their lives. And most people are never going to look things up. We did a Bible study at our house once, and I had a guy sitting right in my living room say to me, you know, I don't believe a lot of this stuff. He says, and I'll tell you, I'm never going to look anything up. I don't care. I'm just not going to believe it. That's pretty powerful. That's pretty powerful when people do that, you know. It's like, I'm going to hell and I'm going to enjoy it. Bye. Boy, that is so dangerous, dangerous. The writers of the four Gospels had been witnesses. Two were apostles, but they were all witnesses. They brought the good news as common, in common language, Koine Greek, which was the language of commerce back then. And they had a firsthand knowledge of the resurrection. They saw it. They saw it. They were either lying, or they were telling the truth, or maybe they were hallucinating. You know, maybe they were hallucinating when they saw the resurrected Jesus. Well, it's kind of interesting. If they were, then all 11 of them were hallucinating the very same way for the rest of their lives. But they wrote things so clearly, so easy to understand. And every one of them died for that faith by people trying to shut them up. That is powerful. The New Testament has been criticized since about 300 AD on, and in the last century, or 2 centuries ago, the 19th century, it reached its peak with liberalism that had entered into the big seminaries on the East and the European seminaries. People have tried to attack the reliability of the Bible, but I can tell you that there has never been an archaeological discovery that contradicts the stories of the Bible. Never. Never. And people would say, well, these things are so old. You know, there's over 25,000 manuscripts going back to the 2nd century and some even in the 1st century that have not perished. You can't say that with any authority. People will lie without evidence, or they'll make assertions. Everybody knew for the first 300 years that this was true. Now, there were papyri discoveries that came to light, and it connected the earliest known testimony with the earliest manuscripts. And I like to quote a Scottish archaeologist there that was an unbeliever, William Ramsay, and he tried as hard as he could most of his life to refute Luke's account, and he couldn't do it. He finally gave up and said, man, it's true. It is true. I've tried as hard as I can. So did others. Josh McDowell did the same thing. He tried as hard as he could, and he ended up believing because he couldn't disprove it. It was so true and so factual. The New Testament people, the evangelists, they were aware of the hostility of the perpetrators of Jesus' crucifixion. We talked about this in our last session. We got a tomb, solid rock, a big, huge rock. It was rolled in place. The Romans sealed it so no one could open it up. They placed guards there. And something happened where the seal was broken and the Roman guards left. How did that happen? Did the Roman guards all of a sudden lose their fighting ability? I don't think so. What caused this to happen? You know, the tomb is empty. The tomb was empty. And both Jewish and Roman sources, the people that were against Jesus, they both admit to an empty tomb. When you got somebody in your opposition admitting to a particular key fact, you won the argument. I mean, they admitted the tomb was empty. And, well, somebody must have stolen, or, you know, he was put in the wrong tomb. That's another wonderful one. Oh, really? So Joseph of Arimathea did not know his own tomb? Nicodemus didn't know what Joseph's tomb was when they carried Jesus over there. The ladies that went to the tomb, they didn't know the right tomb. How does that happen? How does that happen? It doesn't. These are specious arguments at best. At best. People call this a non-resurrection claim. But I got to tell you, the most compelling evidence of anything is the lives of everybody who has changed. And it starts out with the apostles, because every one of those apostles had gone from denying Jesus at the trial, running away, hiding out in an upper room. Hiding out in an upper room in Jerusalem about this. Afraid because they were aligned with this guy that the Romans and the Jews just killed, and now they're probably going to come after us, they're thinking. And they were transformed by something to be on fire for Jesus and jump-started the church. Every one of them died for their faith. Everyone was martyred. You don't go out and preach something under the threat of death if it's a lie. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. Nobody's going to do that. Jesus' half-brother, James, who wrote the epistle, James, he didn't believe Jesus was a Messiah at all, even while he was living. Even while he was living. But after Jesus came back from the dead, he became one of his most ardent followers, wrote a book in the Bible, became the bishop of Jerusalem, conducted the first worldwide church session. He brought the church together for a council. It was the first one. Herod had him killed in 62 AD. Why? Because the Bible says that Christ appeared to him. Christ appeared to all these people. They saw it. When you are an eyewitness account and you see something like that, you're not going to deny it. You can't deny it. You saw it. The people that saw John F. Kennedy die in that Lincoln limousine in Dallas in November of 1963 knew what they saw. My mentor, Dr. Couch, who's gone to be with the Lord, was working at a television station filming that event. You'd never convince him that this didn't happen. You can't. I hear people saying this now. That's starting to creep in now. Well, he probably didn't really die, you know. It may have been just the effort to get Johnson in, you know. And It's amazing what happened. The most dramatic conversion, the Apostle Paul. He was an aggressive persecutor of the church. Aggressive. And when he met Christ on the Damascus Road and was converted, he became the most aggressive missionary the church has ever known. Nobody has done more than the Apostle Paul. He went from being extremely wealthy and influential, a Pharisee, highly educated, to being on fire for Jesus. Talked about his education as being equal with animal refuse, dung. He said, for what I know about Christ, everything that I've learned is just dung. Nothing. Doesn't mean anything. And I press on. He endured poverty, beatings, shipwrecks, stoning, and years of ridicule until Nero took his head off in Rome. Nero beheaded him. And while he was in that Mamertine prison, he's writing these joyous letters about the love of Christ and how wonderful it is to know Christ and where we're going. And I'm sure you remember Philippians 1:21. For me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Because these things are true. Let's pray.